session number 27226, Reel 16.
Reel 16.
Right. Well, we first of all left England to travel down to West Africa with myself and Jack Dyson in an armed merchant cruiser called Silica. We were appointed to the squadron where they had a Kingfisher on board, a Kingfisher aircraft, which I think there was only about three actually operating the whole of the war. And if you remember back to Arbroath, I did make some suggestions about producing a piece of kit that would save aeroplanes, and talking about towing a mesh behind the ship so a hurricane could land on a hook on underneath it and pick up the hurricane and the pilot. And in fact, the Silica was using a mesh to keep the Kingfisher alongside while they hauled it on board with their hoist and everything else. So instead of him having to run on the engines parallel to the ship without a tow, he was actually towed from this net. He took a hook on the net and was lifted on board. Apparently, the Silica went to Freetown, and there was a broadcast about that time. That would be about the time of the North African landings. There was a broadcast signal sent by the Navy that all aircraft on board ship, on board battle cruisers particularly, and that included our merchant cruisers as well, had to go ashore with the pilots, leave their aircraft, and the ships, when they went into dock, they had the catapults and top hamper taken off because they weren't being used for spotting anymore. A major sea change in naval attitudes, because suddenly spotting of guns had become secondary, almost. But the implications of that, as far as the Fleet Air Arm goes, were quite incredible, really, because I think of particularly three or four Walrus pilots who were on ships. It was HMS Sheffield, Dickie Bigwithers on, I can't remember the name of that one now, Cheeseman, who was on the Dorchester off Ceylon, and those people all were Walrus pilots flying supermarine Walruses, and they all end up as COs of fighter squadrons, which is quite incredible. Dickie Bigwithers was thrown ashore. He wandered around the desert not knowing what to do, and he joined a martlet squadron in the desert because it had nowhere to go, and you know, he just joined the squadron, period. And I don't know what happened after that, but he went over to America on the Navy say-so, and he was responsible for getting Corsairs in the end. He said they were good aircraft and had them, and ended up a CO of 1833, I think, were with Hammy Gray, who got the VC at the end of the war. Cheeseman, he was in charge of the Pelham Gang flight of Fireflies from Flying Swordfish. He went to Kenya, which I'll tell you about later on. And Pete Aubrey, he went ashore in North Africa, and they landed in an airfield, which was a French airfield, and took it over. Nobody there, so he left his aircraft in the airfield, went around looking for a place to get a bite and a bun, and he went and found a little estaminet or somewhere off the field, and when he came back, the Americans had found the airfield, surrounded the airfield, and wouldn't let him back on to get his airplane. And he complained bitterly that it was an aircraft, but it was there to be left. Sheffield had gone from there back to Gibraltar.
Why had this change come about with the change from naval spotting? Was there a reason for it at that stage of the
war? Well, the gunnery was essentially a question of spotting aircraft and ranging, and they if they straddled a ship, they pulled back, and so the fact that they got a straddle 100 yards or 50 yards short meant they could change the ranging. And it was very, very important, because the gunnery accuracy was incredible of naval guns, because when a gun fires, of course, it only fires when the ship's absolutely dead level. The big battleships, they're very stable, and if they're rolling like that, they're not fired until they're actually at that position. And so the accuracy came from knowing where the shot, because the control over something like 15 to 20 miles is quite incredible, really. And but then they weren't doing that anymore. They weren't having battleship to battleship activities at all. In fact, battleships from then on, at that time, we're talking about 42, 43, the battleships and cruisers were used for shelling more than anything else, rather than battleship to battleship. Not strictly true, but creating the principle. And so the point of having an aircraft on board a ship with all the top hamper that was there and weight, unnecessary weight, it was not necessary. In other words, it was a saving of a pilot, aircraft, weight and everything else, because they weren't doing the things that the pilots were supposed to be doing at that time. That would gone.
And in your voyage, did you travel in convoy down to...
Pardon?
Did you travel in convoy down to Freetown?
Yes, that was... we set off from Liverpool, I think. Don't know for sure. But we had an interesting run. It was quite quiet until we got off the Canaries, when there's a channel between the main African Africa, and we passed a Spanish ship on the way down, and very shortly afterwards there's all hell let loose, and we're being chased by a submarine through the that area. And I remember particularly watching the lights of the town there coming by. We increased speed quite a lot because we're... It was a fast convoy. The AMC was there. And we went on quite cheerfully, no problem, really, dropped through depth charges and went really down on a very pleasant trip, coming from the cold of winter to a Sierra Leone summer. And alongside Freetown, you saw a beautiful tropical island, lovely green and everything else, until you got ashore, when it stank to high heaven. And it was unbelievably grotty, you know, and you saw all the natives that were all dressed in rags. It was quite a sea change from an English attitude to going to West Africa. I don't think there's much to talk about there on that trip particularly. It was just a luxury cruise, really.
What about accommodation on board?
IMC. We're on luxury accommodation on what was an IMC. It was an old Silica was a P&O liner, but whatever it was. But that was just for us. It was just a jolly, you know. It was quite pleasant, really. And it was a change. We were moving from the cold of English winter and all that cold flying in Scotland to the sun, and it was marvellous, really. And then we got ashore in Freetown to see the difference in the life and the lifestyle. And I think that was probably the major memories I had of Freetown initially. The transition up country, I don't remember. But we ended up at Hastings Airfield, which was a twin of Waterloo for the Fleet Air Army. It was an airfield in near a swamp, almost. Just one runway with another runway, what looked like a runway, it wasn't. It was a road going into the main camp. And we were flying Swordfish, anti-submarine work, for the convoys going up and down the coast from Freetown down south and Freetown north.
How was the airfield organised? Who was in charge and who were the workers?
It's a good question. My memory of Freetown particularly was more of the social conditions under which we operated, and the fact we were flying from an airfield doing AS patrols, and we had... We did some towing work for the army, who were on the coast. Their coastal batteries are quite fun, but by and large, it was rather mundane routine. It was the flying. Got a detail to go off when a convoy came in. In between convoys, you did towing and this sort of thing. And my real concern at that stage, because when I arrived, it was a new base with about 400 native West African Freetown native boys dressed in naval uniform, with some Nigerians from Nigeria, all recruited, strange enough, in West Africa, with a complete disregard to the fact that Essential tribal characteristics of Freetown were very different from Nigeria. The poverty of the sophistication of Nigeria showed very much in the boys that came against the Sierra Leoneans. But they were there to provide all the logistic facilities like feeding, washing, cleaning, malarial spraying for all the pools and ponds and everything else, and aerodrome grass cutting and that sort of thing. The two contracts were out, but they were done by the works department. All these boys in the uniform were Navy, and there were a lot of them, and they did the cleaning and messing and everything else. So that was quite interesting. And of course, when I got there, that was my job. I had to look after 400 of them. And I was thrown straight in the fit, there we are, bang. So that forms a bigger part of my life in West Africa. Flying was quite interesting because when we arrived there, we arrived in January, and the weather was quite benign, but over the next ensuing 6 months, the tropical weather in Freetown was quite horrendous, and I've never known rain like it in my life there or anywhere else. We were behind the Sierra, the big mountain group, and we were in the shadow of it. And one of the things you remember was the clouds used to come over before the rain, and it used to roll down the hills, you know, quite markedly. And one day, and I don't know when, this was later on, we were well settled, so it must have been probably 3 or 4 months in the tour there, we were on Sunday lunch in the mess, which was about 200 yards, maybe, if 200 yards from our cabins. And Sunday being lunchtime, no flying, and it started to rain. And to use a colloquialism, it pissed down. I've never seen rain like it in my life. It came down in serods with thunder and lightning. And we just had our lunch in the wardroom, and it was raining. Now, this is almost unbelievable, but they legislated for this because throughout the camp were deep drainage channels. They're about 2 foot 6 deep and probably a foot wide. We were there in the wardroom. We're being bombarded by lightning. People would jump, fall, you know, all lads who'd been in the on the bombing through Vincent in Pompey and that sort of thing, and they were dropping down on the floor with this thing. We couldn't get out of the wardroom because in the 200 yards between us and our huts was a sea of water with drainage tanks in it about 2 foot deep. If you went into that, there was no way we could stay from there at all. And we had to stay there for about 2 hours while it rained and rained and rained. The wash-off was incredible. You know, it's a natural phenomenon that you don't see very very often. Well, it's encapsulated in a group of huts which have been set up and levelled off and drained for this particular purpose when it suddenly hit. It was quite incredible. The one thing, that's by the way. My job was with the boys, and one of the first problems was that they all lived in a community which was given to them, where they built their own houses out of corrugated iron or whatever they could get. They had the women, the mistresses and the kids all together, and they were living as civilians under naval discipline. These boys provided the guards, and that was a frightening thing because they were given a rifle and told to guard the place and stop anybody who was walking around at night, stopping them and saying, "Halt, who comes here?" I remember it so well. And it's not funny when you're walking around peaceful and quiet and suddenly out of the blue, a pair of, disembodied eyes appear, shouting, you know, "Halt, who comes here?" and pointing a rifle at you. This was what the boys were doing all the time. Quite interesting aspect of life in West Africa.
What degree of training had they received?
What
degree of training had they received?
I've not the faintest idea. As far as I was concerned, those boys were there. We had Suri Sisi, who was a son of an upcountry chief, was my boy, and he was considered king because he was the boy to the man who was in charge of them all. And if we deal with that aspect of the of West Africa first, because I suddenly found myself in charge of 400 indisciplined naval ratings who were subject to naval discipline, living in close to the camp, when in the economics of Freetown, they had no food. They lived on rice. Rice was the basic. There was fruit, plenty of fruit and mangoes and all that sort of thing. And they lived on, they got protein from snakes and this, you know, all natural sources of protein. But rice was the fundamental thing that they needed, and they hadn't any rice. They couldn't get it. The Syrians controlled the market in Freetown. And I came up to me and said, "What, do master no rice?" I said, "Well, what's the problem, sir?" He said, "Can't get any rice, it's too expensive." I said, "Well, who has it all?" He said, "Well, we might have to buy it from the Syrians in Freetown, and they charge too much, so we haven't any money." And so I got into serious strife straight away, which I didn't realise until many years afterwards, I was actually under the control of the RAF. In 200 group, which is on my records, which I never knew. And I went up to Bow, up country, where, strangely enough, Sirius CC, which is another incidental story of recent days, lived to see the district commissioner, because that's where the rice was available. And he said that he would send me a rice, what I wanted. And he kept sending me rice down there by the wagon load from, and I had to buy at a fixed rate. No, I had to sell it at a fixed rate. So I was making a profit, a handsome profit, I must confess. But these boys were highly delighted because not only did they get it, but all the works department, which was another 800 boys, joined in the queue. And the first night, they knew that the rice was there, and they broke into the store where we put it from the delivery and took it all. And I had borrowed the money from the pay bob to pay for it, and we're a bit of a problem, really. But they got some more sent down, we got round that one. And after that, I supplied rice for all the boys at a better price than anybody else, made a profit out of it, and handed it over to my relief when he arrived. And we were supplying literally rice to a community of about 1,200 people just by going up country and short-circuiting the thing. So I'm not complaining about that one. But that was indicative of the sort of things that you found yourself doing in the Navy. You were just thrown in there. You might be a pilot, you might be flying airplanes, you might be sailing ships, but if you were ashore and you were given a job, suddenly you had to do it, you know. And that came later when I went to Burma, when I just shipped out to Burma to find some way of bringing all the aircraft ashore in the event of an emergency. You're just stuck there, chucked by yourself amongst a group of Pongos and RAF people and saying, "This is what we want," and you had to get it. You know, that is indicative of the sort of life we led. So that deals pretty well with Freetown. Let's stop it a minute. Well, anyway, as a result of this, I was in charge of the boys, and I built an office out of a delivery, an aircraft delivery box, and made it into an office and set up a proper organisation with the lads. And basically, I lived on mangoes because there was a mango tree by, and Sirius used to bring me a waste paper basket full of mangoes every day. I mean, my bowels were very well organised. So that's life. I had other duties, of course. We ran it as a ship, a shore ship, and I was only a civil lieutenant. I mean, I was very junior, but there were nobody else, and there was a 2.5, and that was it. We had an RN lieutenant who was very obnoxious. He was against the RNVR people there. It was a bit of a problem. And he was bearded and everything else. And he had his wife out there. We don't know how that happened, but anyway, his wife went out there. And she shacked up with somebody else. And he came into the mess. And he shaved off his beard. Just for no reason. And suddenly, instead of being a lieutenant, a very senior lieutenant, RN, he was a baby-faced lieutenant RN one of the boys, and he was changed differently, and we controlled him a little bit later on. I think he got an appointment to a ship and went. But as interesting, that was relationship between the RN and the RNVR. You know, the classic story of, you must have, somebody told you about it, that the RN were gentlemen, all trying to be officers, and Fleet Air Arm officers trying to be gentlemen, or RNVR neither to be both, that sort of thing. But there was certainly a schism between the Wavy Navy and the Straight Stripers, purely and simply because suddenly the Fleet Air Arm was becoming an elite service, purely and simply what they were doing. And strangely enough, the intake of Fleet Air Arm pilots essentially came from the grammar school level, and they were better educated, and probably in relation to naval officers, much more polite, believe it or not. Not better manner, that would be wrong to say, because there's nothing more polite than an RN lieutenant, you know, in the present day life. But that was a situation. There was a schism there that you had to get over.
It sounds like the relationships changed, though, when you were you were out of the UK almost, though, and you were on a foreign posting. Because you were all together like that, at some stage the relationship would have to come together, and there wouldn't be that schism.
That is right. But this was unusual, because the people, the CEO of Hastings was an ex Channel Island Airways pilot, and he was RN. He was a captain. He was a full Navy captain, straight ringer. And why, I don't know, but I think it was a straight ringer. I never saw him, but he was in charge. And then we had the first lieutenant, who was a lieutenant RN, and the rest of us, our CO, squadron CO, was a 2.5 Wavy Navy, and everybody else was Wavy Navy. So we ran a different ship altogether, just by count of numbers.
How many of you were there?
Pilots? I should say 8 to 10, I think about 10 of us. About, see, I lost my phobia almost. So there must have been 10 or 12 of us, and there must be more, because the observers as well. So I think we had about 10 pilots and the observers as well. Very happy crowd. I mean, we enjoyed ourselves. We went swimming, and a very pleasant existence, just based on flying. And we're all doing something we wanted to do, was fly anyway, in conditions which weren't odious at all. I mean, the Vichy French were over in Conakry, which was only a drop away, and they did come over from time to time. And the RAF shot a Dewatin down during the course of the exercise, about 3 or 4 months into our term there. But
did you mix with any of the RAF in the West in Sierra Leone?
Never saw them that I can remember. Though I know we did have a problem with windsocks, because the boys were, the windsocks was being pinched, and all the kids in, you know, the natives had shell curtains, you know, over the windows, and there was a bit of a bugger because we were running out of them. And so one night we were in the mess, and the drums started to sound, and they're having a little in the goma or whatever they have in the bush. So we thought we'd go and have a look, and we wandered into the bush, which is all tracks. I mean, it was just to where this noise was, and there was natives shambling around the fire just to these drums, round and round and round. I mean, they were just out of their mind, I suppose, full of whatever the arak or whatever it was they drank. But Suri Sisi was with us, and he said he spoke to the witch doctor who was there. These are unbelievable stories, believe me, they're factual. And we were talking about these windsocks, which were all over the place, you know, yellow. And Suri said, well, you know, he would put a juju on the mast if you want to, you know. What's the juju? He said, well, you give him, 50 pence, or whatever, 50 pence or something like that, and we'll have him round, and we'll put a juju on the mast. And we did. He came round and did a little ceremony with some animal bones or something and made a lot of noise. And we paid him his 50 shillings or whatever it was we were supposed to. Nothing really, it was only peanuts. And he tied a string with a yellow piece of one of our windsocks round the mast post. And believe it or not, the people who went near that mast didn't go near it. They went, looked at it and avoided it all. It was unbelievable. We never lost another windsock. Never lost another one. Waterloo never did it. They supplied the natives windsocks. We got to kept ours. Just unbelievable. And also, and I know it's strange, but a man can have a juju in West Africa put on him. And if it happens, and it's usually done by a witch doctor, they know they've got a juju on them, and it does something to them. And I have physically seen, in 6 months, a man who's had a juju put on him, and he changed colour. They have a beautiful mahogany brown in the, you know, they're nicely fed, they're not skinny and that sort of thing. Nicely rounded faces. A man who's got a juju on, you can tell, he goes grey. And when we went to Burma, one aspect of the West African Frontier Force was actually part of another story. My pals who were saving the same mess with us went to Burma and they're out there. And I'll tell you that story later on. But I saw the boys who'd been out there fighting in Burma, and I'd been away for nearly 18 months, 2 years. And those boys had changed colour. They'd taken it out of them. They were not the nice, polished, ebony. They'd lost something. They'd lost the joie de vivre, really. They were quite incredible how it had taken it out of the native soldiers. People don't recognise this, but it was very, very true. And they did a lot of work in Burma. It's with and without their boots.
So how important was juju to your workforce?
Not really. It was just an ancillary to it, really, because we'd never use it. But it was known that it happened, and we'd hear about these things, but the bullshit. But when you actually see physically people who are quite normal people actually voiding a lamppost because they know it's got a juju on it, they've got a piece of string, and going away, you know that there's something psychologically powerful there as well. Quite strange sort of way of life, really.